traveled around. There's snow on the ground. But that doesn't matter very much. I got here to this receiving door.
Noe Mach is the performance name for one Robert Joseph Antonio Francisco of Philadelphia. His LP is called In the Shadows. We heard Fetico. Behind us now, Ferrante and Teicher from Soundproof, The Sound of Tomorrow Today, is The Mermaid Waltz. Before Max Noe Mach, we heard from Rita Lee, 1972's Jorge e O Primero Dia de Resto, the track called Freak Comigo. Rita Lee was preceded by The Great Ill Ease, Bits and Pieces, the name of the MP3 release. We heard Everybody Gets It in the End, parenthetically, The White Radiance of Eternity. Cave before that, compilation called Every Noise Has a Note. Cave gave us the track Machines and Muscles. Peter Gordon before that, 30-year compilation, or 30-year retrospective called Love of Life Orchestra. And we heard a track called Another Heartbreak / Don't Redux, his 2009 remix of his own 1979 material. Harry Nilsson from a 7-inch, Don't Forget Me, the name of the song that also showed up on the Pussycats record he made with John Lennon. Arthur Russell and the Flying Hearts featuring Allen Ginsberg, very strange New Jersey song, Ballad of the Lights. It's everything we heard. My name is Scott. Has been a joy. I look forward to seeing y'all next week. Stay tuned for Benjamin Walker and Too Much Information. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope worldwide, WFMU.org. Bye-bye.
Giant, what's new besides ho ho ho?
What's that you're eating? Oh, fruit cocktail. But the flavors have all run together. If fruit cocktail tastes like a blur to you, here, try Libby's.
If Las Vegas weren't Las Vegas, and you know what that means, it would still be one of the West's great vacation lands. Odds are, it would still attract millions of people just for its great championship golf courses. Or for a tour of Hoover Dam.
Hey, look around. New things are happening. More and more people are picking up on Hunt's catsup.
Could big tomato taste be the difference?
Hi. Maury Amsterdam calling. Really? Yep, I checked, and it's me, all right. Well, I'm talking to you on behalf of Dow Corning, and I'd sure like to be half of Dow Corning.
Wells Fargo is the only bank with stagecoaches on its checks. And our stagecoach checks are easy on your feet because you don't have to walk around town to pay your bills.
Bob and Jenny Miller were born rich.
Platform in New York City. The subway station was 79th Street and Broadway, and you get the 1, 2, 3 lines coming through all at the same time, 2 express, 2 local, and 4 trains in fact came through at the same time, creating the maximum amount of subway noise you could possibly have, at least in that station. And there was a lot of other noise going on in my life, sort of mental and psychological, as well as my kids were there and making a fuss, and it all kind of just coagulated at that point, just became way too much for me. I had a mini freak out, just saying to myself, I can't deal with this.
After that moment of sonic overload on the 79th Street Broadway subway platform, author George Foy began asking questions about his oral existence, like, how loud is it? And how loud is too loud? Then he went and bought a portable decibel meter.
Decibels are a way of measuring the sound pressure against your ear. The lowest sound that we're apt to hear is somewhere around 20 decibels, which is like a feather hitting a tabletop. 100 decibels is a jet, maybe a few hundred meters away from you. You get higher than that, and you're talking about lethal levels if you're anywhere close to that kind of sound. And it's an exponential measure in that it doubles the level with every 3 extra decibels. In other words, 43 decibels is double 40 decibels, and so on and so forth. The actual spectrum of sound waves between 120 and 0 decibels is roughly a trillion times. In other words, it's a trillion orders of magnitude greater than 0 at 120 decibels. So anyway, I went into the subways and I measured the sounds that the subways were inflicting on me, and they were way over 100 decibels, which is actually physically damaging to your ears. But even within the subway car, the noise levels are fairly high, and if you're subjected to these on a constant basis, the tests and scientific studies have proved that, in fact, your physical hearing is going to deteriorate over time.
When George Foy measures the soundscape of his existence, he discovers that not only is the volume too high, but that the noise is everywhere.
People think of hostile sound as loud, but it doesn't necessarily have to be high volume. What it is, it's pervasive. It's everywhere. It's useless information. It's radios, TVs, iPods. It's marketing calls. It's the recorded messages in airports. It's elevator music, NPR, your kids playing video games. The information that's coming at you from all levels, including, you know, when you're online, all this stuff kind of comes together into what I feel anyway, and I think a lot of people do feel, as being an overload of sensory input of different kinds, and they all feel the same, and they all feel like noise, actually, which is why they're called noise. They're called often white noise, even when it's visual, even when it's when it's coming at you through different senses.
After George Foy discovers how loud his life is, he sets out to find some silence. He decides the antidote to all the noise is 0 decibels.
0 decibels is actually the level at which a sample of 100 people without hearing loss stop hearing anything. But in fact, that doesn't mean that there's no sound waves in the air at that point. It just means that we're not really aware of them. I think totally psychologically lost hope that I was going to find absolute silence. But obviously the science was indicating that there's no such thing as no input. Even if you go into the farthest reaches of space, particles exist even in deep space. And sound is particles rubbing against each other, creating waves. So then, in fact, you get all our universe apparently is suffused with actual measurable music, although we couldn't possibly hear it with our ears. And even on Earth, the places that I was measuring were not totally silent.
In his book, 0 Decibels, George Foy documents his quest for absolute silence. He tours the catacombs of Paris, he talks to astronauts, he even visits the quietest place in the world, an anechoic chamber in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
It's apparently the most perfect soundproof chamber in existence in the world. In fact, the Guinness Book of World Records rates it as the quietest place on Earth, and you can look that up. And apparently, I mean, to go in there and to experience perfect sound, you need to turn off the lights, and of course, there's no sound. It's 3 cubes, 2 of steel, 1 of concrete, nestled within each other on springs. They're absolutely sheathed in sound-damping material. It's a really impressive kind of science fiction place. And apparently, to a lot of people who go in there and try it out, it is very, very scary. It freaks them out because you are used to having your senses registering something at all times, and all of a sudden, there's nothing there. You can't see anything, by definition, total darkness. And in human terms, at least, pretty much total silence. And for a split second, I had this sense of like this bubble that was in my ear, and it was surrounding an emptiness. There was just nothing there. It was the most perfect silence that I ever had or ever will probably hear. And then, of course, I realized immediately that I was making noise. My body was making noise. I could hear my pulse. I could hear the skin rubbing over the scalp rubbing over my skull. In fact, I was my own hearing system was actually making noise, as it turned out, or that's the probable explanation. So, but in that split second, I did feel something, and it was kind of a wonderful feeling. And what was even more wonderful, actually, was the corollary of all that was that, having found that split second, having done all this research and traveling in search of this, and understanding more and more about both relative silence and sound, I was just reveling in the complexity and the beauty of sound and all its different spectra and all its ability to make us crazy, to make us happy, to make us understand the world we live in. I mean, sound is such a basic, it's the alarm medium. It's the primary sense that tells us how safe we are in the world. And as such, it's capable of giving us great, great security, great pleasures through music and so forth. And also, of course, great fear and great anxiety when it's misused or when it signals danger.
My name is Crank Sturgeon, and I am a noise artist of sorts. I'm sort of a backwards storyteller, pseudo-quasi-dadaist, and one who amplifies the right and the wrong thing at the right and the wrong time. Plugging things in backwards, forwards, two-way, back way. This piece is done with what's called a Victorian synth, or actually working with Victorian age technology to create a synthesizer, which basically means taking a speaker and for a sound source, wire it to a 9-volt battery, and you're feeding a wire from one end of the battery on top of the speaker and like another line from the speaker on top of itself. So when the two touch, they vibrate and the speaker just like vibrates, you know, immensely. And it kind of creates its own, it's not really audio feedback, but it's electronic feedback. It's just, it's gorgeous because it's uncontrollable. It's really just like pure noise at its best, because your role as author, performer, musician, artist, whatever you want to call it, is really limited by whatever type of metal is sort of holding against the cone and whatever you decide to add on top of it, like magnetic metal, springs, bits of, you know, paper clips, what have you, that will also rattle and crattle inside this thing. And the result is just phenomenal. I mean, it's just so big and boomy and harsh and wonderful. And, you know, and the best way to amplify it, of course, is you just take a contact mic and hold it on the speaker and run it through a PA, and people just can't believe that you're doing this to them. So as you can see, I'm laughing. I'm not exactly, you know, harsh in attitude, only in I guess I derive great pleasure and joy from the sound of things collapsing, not because I'm malevolent, but only because I just love the sound of things falling down. So, including myself.
I'm concerned, if a group of people are gathered to hear some form of sound art, however raucous or cacophonous, I have a very hard time calling that noise. I say the essential difference between music and noise is not acoustic or aesthetical, but ethical.
Garrett Kaiser also wrote a book on noise. It's called The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want. Kaiser wants us to better understand how noise can lead to conflict, often violent conflict. Sometimes the violence is directed at the noisemaker, and sometimes it's the complainer who gets attacked. Kaiser's noise timeline starts with the Epic of Gilgamesh, when the gods are so offended by their noisy human neighbors, they send a flood to wipe them out. His book is filled with stories about people fighting over noise. And while none of these fights are probably going to result in another Epic of Gilgamesh-style worldwide apocalypse, Kaiser does believe that noise is a key to further our understanding of the things that do threaten our existence.
Certainly in disputes that end in violence, either against the noisemaker or by the noisemaker, we're touching on some pretty fundamental questions about the beginning and the end of our rights. And an example that I've often used is, you know, if I drive by your house and I throw a piece of litter through your open window, I can probably be arrested. But if I drive by your house and throw a piece of acoustical litter through your window, and you complain about it, you might just be told that you should, you know, get over it and be more tolerant. So I think people, when they argue about noise, are also arguing about rights and about, you know, how we accommodate each other in a society. I also think that environmentally, when we have arguments or just discussions about noise, we're talking about the volume of our civilization. How much is too loud? And how much is sustainable? The things that make noise also make carbon.
Yeah, but if you're going to start talking about rights, though, and acoustical litter, though, doesn't it seem, though, that this is one of Americans, inalienable rights, the rise to make noise, stick it to the man, live loud, live fast? Isn't that, just part of the American way?
Well, I would hope that is not, but historically that's at least, I think, been part of our culture, not only in the public square, but in foreign policy relations. Let it rip, play it loud, go for it, and make as much noise as you want. I think where it becomes disingenuous is when we wrap every inconsiderate noise we might make, or every product that we're asked to buy that makes noise, in this mantle of American freedom and American rights. And I actually believe that we have been encouraged to buy that bill of goods, that idea that, hey, all you need is a motorcycle or a boombox, and you're committing almost an act of revolution. Meanwhile, your birthright's being stolen. Your hours are being increased that you have to work. Your pay's being cut. Your benefits are being taken away. But, you're like a real radical sort of person because you have a nose ring and because you can make noise.
It also seems a corollary to that, though, is that people like yourself who complain about noise often get demonized as being elitists or cranks.
Oh, most definitely. An elitist has become... maybe the most used political cant term in our society, is often leveled that the person who wants quiet is an elitist. And I think one of the things that makes that complaint sometimes rather questionable is you have somebody who makes $120,000 a year driving a $20,000 jet ski and calling somebody in a canoe an elitist because they want a little space of the water where they can be quiet and be by themselves.
It also seems that noise for you is a way of getting to political truth. You say that that noise has an uncanny way of telling the truth. What are you getting at with that?
When we have sound that potentially robs us of our hearing, and when we hear that sound, it automatically raises a question. I mean, the first question is, what the heck is that? Or where's that coming from? Or what's wrong with those people? Or doesn't anybody sleep around here? But then other questions beyond that have to do with, how do things like quiet and noise and other benefits and detriments get distributed in our society? And for me, one of the primary political questions has to do with distribution and justice. Who gets the peanuts and who gets the shells? Noise is not the most important issue that there is, but it is a doorway into talking about some of the really big issues of justice and also environmental sustainability. And in our tendency to dismiss noise because it seems like a relatively small issue, and also because many of the people most affected by noise are people who don't count in our estimation as much as other people. They're kids, they're old people, they're poor people, they're minorities, they're soldiers, they're prisoners. That in that tendency we have to dismiss small issues because we have a bigger agenda, We have to liberate the holy lands from the infidels. We have to stop global climate change. We have to destroy terrorism. And therefore, because we're doing such important things, we can disregard small communities, small people, small creatures, small issues, that we find the very attitude that gives us the big issues. That the same attitude that says, this old lady's got a problem with noise, get over it. Oh, so the snail darter's going to be extinct. Get over it. Then suddenly the sea levels are rising. How did that happen? Well, it happened in part because of our tendency to say that anything that we don't regard as really big is unimportant.
This is GX Jupiter Larson, and I'm with a project called The Haters, and we spent a great deal of time over the past 30-plus years making a lot of noise. Back in the late 70s, I used to make a habit of getting kicked out of bands for not learning how to play my instrument, whichever one that happened to be. Usually it was a guitar. And, you know, because everyone at the time always talked about punk like it was some kind of, you know, noisy endeavor. But it was never all that noisy to me, and I always wanted to try to find some kind of project, some kind of outlet for, you know, for the noise that I wanted to make, and that's how The Haters came about. And, you know, it kind of started out more in a band-type format and became much more theatrical, far more kind of performance art-oriented, and... you know, it ended up being like this, you know, this outlet of celebrating entropy. This piece is a collaboration with Raphael, and it was the first opportunity, or at least the first collaboration, I believe, I did where I didn't use any of my own sounds. I used only the sounds provided by my collaborator. And the idea for me was to try to make a piece sound like what I would normally do, but use somebody else's sounds. Because I have this tendency to focus on sounds, well, the sounds of entropy, you know, glass breaking, car accidents, grinding, sanding, what have you. And Raphael doesn't use those kind of sounds at all. And so I thought it'd be interesting to try to translate his palette, you know, through my eyes, or through my ears in this case. You know, this whole mass media overstimulation kind of leaves a lot of us very numb. And I think occasionally people like to step away from the mass media overstimulation. And noise is a very effective means of clearing the head, as it were. You experience the sound. You don't really hear it. You if you do hear it, you hear it through your gut. You hear it through the way that the standing waves actually affect your vision. You know, K2 always said that noise was the sounds you couldn't refuse. And I think that's true. I think there's a sense of creating an experience that you just have to deal with, either directly or indirectly, but you cannot not refuse it or not listen to it, or you have to react to it one way or the other. You're trying to, I guess, in a sense, surf on entropy. You're trying not to fall in head first. You're trying to keep a balance so that you're not overwhelmed by chaos. I mean, entropy is a very interesting thing. If it wasn't for entropy, we would have no idea that time existed, you know, because through entropy, you know, we age, and there's a, you know, it's the very means of rot and decay. And I think there's a certain elegance to that. The fact that very elements in biology that creates life also takes it away simultaneously. So there's always this sense of trying to find balance in the chaos. And, you know, this has both beautiful and ugly connotations, and I think that trying to find a balance in the beauty and the ugliness is quite interesting. Noise people, noise artists, musicians take sounds that they themselves, for whatever reason, are obsessed with. They'll have a certain appreciation, and that appreciation can be very base. It can be very raw and irrational. But they have a certain interest in a sound or sound effect, and it may be an interest that very few, if anyone else, shares. But nevertheless, they feel compelled to explore the dynamics of this particular sound. And for many noise people, noise artists and musicians, does not necessarily have to be compositional. I mean, you know, music, regardless what sound you use, and you can use any sound in music, but you're still approaching it in terms of composition. For a lot of noise people, the composition isn't important. It's not the issue. It is the sound in and of itself. So that's a different attitude. It's a different approach. It's a much more kind of raw, much more emotional approach to sound than, say, being a composer, which is actually more of a mathematical approach to dealing with sound. I think noise tends to be much more emotional. And because it's emotional, it's not always appreciated in the same way by everyone.
The idea that quiet and the democratic process go together is an inspiring one, but I can't say it completely assuages the anxiety associated with sensitivity to sound.
George Prochnick is very sensitive when it comes to noise. Once, he called the cable guy because the DVR unit was clicking off too loud. He's also written a new book about noise. It's called In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. When he suggested we meet in Central Park, I said, sure. I figured since he's so obsessed with silence, he must know all the super secret quiet spots in the park. But, well, I figured wrong.
Well, I mean, I think that we can postulate genetic predispositions to louder and quieter environments. Certainly, I fall on the side of silence. And I think my predilection for silence is really a desire to see and feel and hear as much as possible. We're about to hear a noise right now.
Oh, the Brinks truck has shown up.
And
we're walking through Central Park here, and we've got kids screaming, airplanes going overhead, and I'm trying to hear, I'm trying to follow you somewhere quiet.
Well, you know, I think when you say that, it leads me to bring up one thing that I think is really important for everyone to do, which is to spend some time in the environments where most of your day passes. Try this. Close your eyes wherever you are and just remain absolutely still for a couple of minutes. Don't try to meditate. Just become aware of what you're hearing. And I remember I had an experience a few blocks from here when I was with a peculiar group of people who do engage in this spontaneous street meditation where they all walk around and drop down, sit cross-legged, close their eyes, meditate for a couple of minutes with someone watching over them. Well, I did this. We walked around Columbus Circle several times. And by the second time I did this, and I walk by Columbus Circle 4 or 5 times a week. By the second time I did this, when I sat there, what I was hearing sounded to me like the soundtrack of a horrifying, horrifying horror film. It was so extraordinarily painful and grating. And I, who am reasonably sensitive to my acoustical environment, had no consciousness of how intense it was. The positive side of that is it shows us how little it takes to sensitize ourselves a little bit more to the sound world that we actually live in. And I think if we were all to do that very simple of experiment of spending a couple of minutes with our eyes closed, not moving, in the places where we spend time, we would have a great desire to change the sound of a lot of those places, to subtract a number of the noises that are just sheer battering forces.
And the airplane that's about to drown you out once again.
Maybe the biggest problem of all we face right now. I mean, that's what we really don't know how to get away from. We don't know what to do about it. It's extremely hard to soundproof yourself against them. New York is particularly wretched.
Doesn't New York seem to be maybe the wrong city for a guy like you?
Well, you know, I have a long history in the city, so I'm here partly because of that. And also, I mean, I don't think it has to sound like this. And I think we can't despair and feel that this is the only way it can be. I think that for a long time now, we've ghettoized the idea of silence along two tracks. First of all, there's the older religious track, where people associate silence with meditation, with being closer to God, with all these things, which is fine and true for those people who have faith that promotes the idea of silence. But as we know, large numbers of people do not, and ever greater numbers of people don't have that religious option as a vein for silence. And moreover, many of the mega churches now, etc., are some of the loudest places around. So even the traditional associations between pursuit of God and silence, I think, are diminishing. And then on the other hand, you have commodified silence. You have the ability to buy very expensive soundproofing and go on quiet retreats that can be exorbitant in cost, and to do all those sort of private modes of self-pampering that can be associated with sound.
I think the weed whacker guy's coming.
Go for it.
Sorry. You know, I think that the key thing about this moment in time is people feel the noise is inescapable, you know? We're certainly not going to get anywhere, I think, by just shouting, be quiet. And in fact, one of the most poignant experiences for me when I was researching my book was speaking with kids in disadvantaged neighborhoods who literally have no experience of silence in their lives. Their homes are very loud, filled with different kinds of entertainment devices and people shouting and all sorts of problems in the domestic environment. Then they go out onto loud streets, the stores are loud, the restaurants are loud, often their schools are very loud as well. These kids literally have no moment of quiet in their lives. So to tell them you have to shut up is really meaningless, and in fact is callous to the reality of their auditory existences. I think rather than that, what we've got to begin doing is broadening people's sense of what silence can mean. So what we have to accept is that we're not going to be able, particularly now with fractured faiths and fractured lack of faiths, to really come up with some dogma of silence. But what we might be able to do is come up with a consensual effort to produce experiences or access to experiences of silence for large swaths of society, in which people then could discover what they will. And for many people who have no experiences of silence, I think this is vital if we want to ever change the way the world sounds. Why should people not only be quieter, but why should they care about silence if they don't know what it is? And it's because it's not something we can talk about, it's only going to be experiential. We simply have to make those experiences more broadly available.
It seemed that one of the things you learned, though, while working on this project, was that there might not be so much a hatred of silence, but almost that a lot of people who are really into loud noises are actually trying to drown out other loud noises.
Exactly. I think that I saw this again and again, including among some of the biggest noise aficionados that there are, these people who are involved with car audio competitions, who I went down to see one group of them in Florida. And, you know, these people have boom cars that are so powerful they crack windshields and tear the metal of the hoods of their cars. But really, when I spoke with them about why they made so much noise, what the attraction was, on the one hand, it was clear that they just, you know, there's that sensual appeal of loud bass, which everyone, to the extent that they're willing to open themselves to it, is going to experience. I mean, it's just a very powerful thing, that sound that gets inside you and shakes your organs around. But the other thing is, the environment in which they live is just a noise dumping ground. I mean, it's nothing but crisscrossing highways and awful malls blasting all sorts of cacophonous tunes at you. There's nothing worth hearing. And I think, you know, there's so much worth hearing in an environment that hasn't been polluted in that way by just a completely neglectful, wasteful, sonic fill of one sort or another. Environments where we let ourselves get back to that more natural human layer of sounds. It's going to be conversations, that's going to be birds and wind and all those things that in some ways we have now shown, again, through lots of quite rigorous scientific research, that these have beneficial psychological effects on us. And we can speculate about the reasons for that, but it just seems to be the case. And I think we now, in this sort of wasteland of mechanical and electroacoustic noises, we're not getting what we need in our acoustical diet. For most of us, the acoustical diet that we ingest on a daily basis is very heavy in fat, in sonic junk. We have extremely few nutritious polyvalent sounds in the course of our day, and we have very little silence in our diet. I think if we were to try to imagine a sonic pyramid of what might be healthy, that large portions of quiet in the course of our day interrupting the constant wave of noise that we're involved in would be seen as something really beneficial and wouldn't involve us having to try to turn down the overall decibel level of the world around us. I think that's a really important point. It's not that we need absolute quiet, but we need to interrupt this constant besiegement. We need to find ways of doing that aren't just private ways. You know, I don't think it does any good to preach to the converted. You need to find 20 minutes a day where you go and you sit in quiet. Yes, but we also need to make those options more available and more obvious in our urban fabric. We have an addiction right now to overstimulation. And noise is a big part of that. You know, I was very struck, I will say one more study, I was very struck by a study that was done on rats a couple of years ago in Italy, where they took a group of rats, divided it into two, put one group of rats in a typical quiet laboratory setting and another in a room that had a sound level typical of a discotheque. And they administered to both these groups of rats low doses of ecstasy. And they found that the rats who were given the drug in the relatively quiet environment... do we need to pause for a second?
Yeah. Wow, it feels great, though.
Yeah.
And...
one more gust. There it goes.
Perfect.
Okay. So...
there's a study.
So there's a study done with two groups of rats. They administered low doses of ecstasy to one group of rats in a quiet laboratory setting and to another group of rats in a room that had a sound level of a typical discotheque. The rats who were given ecstasy in the quiet room, their brains straightened out in less than 24 hours. The rats who were given the drug in the loud environment took more than 5 days for their electrocortical parameters to straighten out. What that means is that the noise actually increased the toxicity of the drugs. Not to endlessly be bringing up studies, but there's been research done on the ways that people drink more in loud bars. So there are different reasons for this. On the one hand, people can't talk, so maybe they drink also to make up for the fact that they're not having conversation. But also, I'm convinced that the intoxicant is going to be that much more intense with noise. So, you know, until we try to look for other forms of stimulation that basically ask a little bit more of us, ask us to reach out with our own powers of imagination and perception and experience the wealth of sensory possibilities in our world, not just be stuffed with them, we're really going to be damned. By dialing it down, I think what we're going to get is the kind of discovery that archaeologists made when they uncovered fantastic tombs in Egypt, where suddenly they find rich mosaics of sonic possibilities, where before there was just sand and blasting desert desert browns. You know, when we take back the kinds of stimulation which we have come to accept as the norm, and with an extraordinary levels of hyperarousal as the norm, I think what we're going to find is just a mosaic of different sorts of sounds, a kind of richness that is going to have the potential to enlarge our awareness of the natural world, of the human world, in terms of being able to hear more of what's going on around us, and, you know, ultimately of, even for people who aren't spiritually inclined, of a sense of possibility of something larger than the self. Noise nails us back down on our own body, and when we ask for the volume to be ratcheted up and ratcheted up, we're getting it inside ourselves. We're feeling ourselves absolutely, you know, in a robotic sense, one with that sound. But we're not feeling ourselves. We're not feeling anything ultimately but our own bodies and our own relationship to that mass pulsing. We're not feeling anything like the actual spectrum of sonic wonders that the world, sonic and just sensory wonders that the world presents us if we can only have the opportunity to hear it.
Sarah Lipstate, and I record music under the name Noveller. Sometimes people say that I'm a noise musician or a noise artist because when Noveller originally started, there was a lot of just manipulating feedback and not really using traditional sound sources like I use now, like the guitar or whatever, to generate sound. So I could see how people would associate me with noise music or label me a noise musician. People can sometimes make a big deal about women making experimental music or noise music, and there's kind of this penchant for lumping us all together in these compilations. Saying like, hey, look what these girls are doing. And a lot of times those compilations are organized by women and they view it as a community building exercise, which it is. And it is cool to, you know, become aware of these other women all over the country or all over the world. But, sorry, I don't think that noise is really a dude thing. Box of gear. I have all of the pedals that I use for Noveller live shows and recordings. And all my cables and all the various objects that I use on my guitar to make sound. The process kind of changed a lot for me when I was writing this new record, Desert Fires. Before Desert Fires, I think my approach to making sound was kind of more reliant and influenced by my gear. And I would kind of set everything up and, you know, lay the guitar out, maybe pull out my cello bow or like an e-bow or something, some kind of device, and just like turn on like my distortion, one of my distortion pedals or something, and then kind of go from there. And relying a lot on the gear and using the guitar more as just a sound generator instead of a tool for composing. But for this new record, I actually started with the guitar and spent a lot of time with the guitar actually not plugged into anything. I was kind of bummed out about stuff that was going on in my personal life, and I wasn't doing it because I was like, oh, I need to start thinking about the new record. It was just kind of like, it made me feel better to just sit with my guitar and be doing something. Like, I didn't care enough to set up my pedals or even for a while bring my amp in there. It's just like, I don't want to get out of bed, so I'm going to bring my guitar into the bed. That way I don't have to leave the bed and I can still make music and it'll make me feel better. So, yeah, it was a really different approach where I was kind of writing these songs based on more traditional guitar playing, or, you know, where the more basic blocks of like, this is a chord, or, you know, this is like a finger-picked melody. And after a couple of weeks of doing that, then I brought in my pedals. I moved into my music room, and it was before I'd set up my studio, which we're in right now. But I moved into the other music room and started playing some of like the chords and stuff that I had written when I was confined to my bedroom, and bring it into my setup and kind of letting songs evolve that way. And it did, and it was kind of amazing how these like chord progressions that I was playing in my bed unamplified turned into these crazy like delayed arpeggiated melodies once I incorporated my effects pedals and started recording. So let's see what I have to work with here. I have to time my performances because even if I'm on tour and I'm playing the same four or five songs every single night, one night it could be a 20-minute long performance and the other night it could be a 45-minute long performance. Because even though I'm playing these pieces that are have a structure and, you know, are composed, the way that I play them is different every time. And sometimes I'll add things, sometimes I'll just stretch things out and just, you know, let them breathe more. But yeah, even though they're composed pieces with structure, there's improvisation just innately built in. People really need to grasp on to like the process and like, where is the sound coming from? And, you know, is it something that you had pre-planned out, or were you just making all that up on the spot? And it's both.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Listening to Noise. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, Bill Bowen, and Laura Mayer. It featured George Foy, Crank Sturgeon, Garrett Kaiser, GX Jupiter Larson, George Prochnick, and Sarah Lipstate. Special thanks to Fritz Welch. On the Too Much Information playlist page, you can find more information on the books and music featured in the program, and you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.
kele soro nura ko wole kamare nyari sa Kelenta kamare nyari bi mi kamare nyari bi ibi masola mara dasira ka wale kamare nyari sa minata fariga denke pa mai kamare mbale Almilo farafina dama suluku sinto almilo almilo ne tabali kunya ne mbursa meme almilo
Charge and try again. Insufficient to make a call. Please recharge and try again.
Bye. The number you have dialed is not available.
WFMU, my name's DJ Rupture, and this is Mud Up 702 here.
Disorder, derangement,
and this is The Queen Speaks by Moon Wiring Club.
Mix.